and this is Community Radio. It's KFAI 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and St. Paul, online and archived at kfai.org. Sure, take a deep breath, have another hit of fresh air.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. This is Right on Radio, the show where we talk about all things literary. Tonight, Emma sits down with Janice Fairbanks to talk about her book, Sugarbush Babies, Stories of My Ojibwe Grandma. Then afterwards in the show, Eric sits down with Timothy Odie about being the co-owner of Wild Rumpus Books, a children's bookstore based out of Minneapolis. Stay tuned for Right on Radio.
All right, I have Janice Fairbanks here to talk to her, with her about her book, Sugarbush Babies, Stories About My Ojibwe Grandmother. Thank you so much for being with us today, Janice.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
So my kind of softball question here is, what prompted you to write this?
Probably my grandmother, because it's stories I've been writing all of my life. Mm-hmm. They've just recently come together in a book and been published. So a lot of things prompted me to write those original stories, and it was just the way I grew up, I guess. Going from a reservation to a city and then back to a reservation and back and forth. And all of my experiences along there, and they all tied right back to my grandma. So
were you always considered a writer then? Or?
Oh, I was considered a writer since second grade.
Oh my God.
yes, I was. Because I mean, I did start storytelling, writing my own stories in second grade. And of course, they evolved a little bit beyond my second grade abilities. but my classmates liked them, so that was good enough for me.
Were you always a big fan of writing fiction more? Or like, what was like kind of writing that you gravitated towards?
I like history.
Okay.
And in a way, my writing has always been history. It's been the history of the Ojibwe people.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's fact-based. It's actual stories of things life. So for my reading material, I do like reading biographies, autobiographies. Mm-hmm. I like reading about people to kind of see what motivates people or what turns them off. You have to know those things to get along with people, and I really like people. I mean, I want to get along with people, so I want to make sure I don't offend anybody. Sometimes I probably do, but it's not intentional.
Yeah. I'm curious where the title Sugarbush Babies comes from.
That was my grandma. Yeah. My grandma was a Sugarbush baby. She was actually born at Sugarbush Camp, and Sugarbush is when the season turns in March to go, usually in March, to go out into the woods, tap trees to make the maple sap. Mm-hmm. And back in those days, when she was born in 1895, it was the woman's job to do that. Now everybody does it, men, women, children, but it was women's work. And so she was out there and with her mother, not born yet, but in the middle of all that, then she was born on March 11th at Sugarbush. So when she told me the story of her birth, she referred to herself as a Sugarbush baby. So that just kind of stuck with me that, yeah, she's a Sugarbush baby. And she continued tapping trees well into her old age. All her life, she was Sugarbush baby.
That sounds like is it a pretty strenuous labor, do you think? Or is it pretty stressful?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
And well, it takes time to tap the trees, and then you have to wait for the sap to run and fill the little. In those days, she used coffee cans and cedar taps. Now they have all kinds of fancy equipment, tubing and everything. Well, back then, she didn't. She was walking the woods and carrying those pails, and she had a couple of her regular people that came to Sugarbush to help her. She had her uncle Mike, and then there was a guy named Tommy Stevenette. Mm-hmm. Those were her two regular helpers. And they did a lot of the heavy work, but she did quite a bit too, pouring the sap from the pails onto the fire and watching that and making sure it didn't burn as it boiled down. So it's a lot of labor, and it goes on until, they say, until the frogs start singing. When you hear the frogs start singing, it's time to stop that tapping the trees.
Oh, that's so cool. My next question is, there's a lot of photos. One of my favorites, I think it's in the prologue, and especially towards the end in the epilogue with like your grandmother in the jingle dress. What was it like going through all these photographs to include or exclude? Can you describe that process?
Well, I have a collection, and that picture has always been one of my favorites. It's on my wall. It's mm-hmm. always been hanging on my wall, that one of my grandma. And when I got to be about the same age, I put on my jingle dress mm-hmm. and I posed like her.
Oh my
and that's
God.
In the book too. They're across from each other. That younger version yeah. of me is across from my grandma. And they were about the same age when those pictures were taken. So, you asked me, what was it like going through all those pictures?
Yeah.
Actually, the publisher asked me for certain illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
So all I had to do was go through and find illustrations that fit what they asked for.
Perfect.
So it wasn't too hard. I got direction on that.
Yeah. Were there like ones that you really, really wanted to include? Did you find like while you're going through these photographs, you were rediscovering some photos that you're like, oh, I didn't know about this or things like that?
The pictures of my elementary years were kind of a surprise. Somebody sent me that picture that it's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And third, was that Franklin anyway? I had one from Jackson. I don't know. One of them wasn't good enough to go in the book. Not high enough resolution. When
yeah.
I say not good enough, it wasn't high enough resolution. So that one didn't get in there. But one of them did. And that one was sent to me by one of my classmates who was in the elementary school with me.
Oh,
that was a surprise.
I think, because like when it comes to like memoirs or talking about other people or stories, what was your friends, family's reaction to you writing this book? Were they kind of stoked, kind of shocked, or were they like, oh, this is just a natural progression for your literary career?
My friends' families? I'm
or
not
like
sure
your
I
friends,
understand the question.
Like your friends and family members, when you're writing this book or you're telling them that you're writing this memoir.
They were remembering, it was helping them yeah. remember some of their own yeah. childhood memories,
mm.
which is good. Yeah. They told me stories yeah. that they're their stories, so they didn't get into my book.
Yeah.
But I told them they should write a book.
Yeah.
There's some interesting thoughts out there. And then I've heard from a lot of my friends that heard some of the stories, because I've done occasional readings just because I had these stories all these years. They just weren't in a book. They were in a manuscript.
Yeah.
So I would read from them from time to time, and that would have the same effect on them. They would remember their grandmother in particular. That came up pretty often. Oh, I remember my grandma. I wish I would have visited her more. I wish I would have talked to her more. There's yeah. a lot of that. And that's just so important. If you've got your ancestors right there, spend time with them and talk to them. It's way more interesting than anything I can think of. That was just, it's just my outstanding memory of my life was spending conversation time with my grandma.
This book actually inspired me to talk to my grandmother a little bit. She's in her mid-80s. She's my last living grandmother. And she did grow up on a reservation in upstate New York. And I never really asked her questions about it that much. And so thank you from a personal note, because that's inspiring me to ask her questions about like what it was like growing up in rural upstate New York. So thank you for that. I don't think I would have thought much about it.
Was it a Mohawk reservation by any chance? What was the name of the reservation?
It was a Tuscarora, I believe. And our family is
Tuscarora, yeah.
Yeah. Our family's very white. We don't have indigenous mm-hmm. culture, but she somehow grew up on a reservation. I don't know exactly how that happened. And then they moved closer to Niagara Falls, Buffalo area, she was a kid. So I thought that was
Is your grandmother Tuscarora?
No. She's second gen Polish. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. It was weird. From what she told me, it was all the reservation Native American kids would just, like, it was 50% Polish and like other Eastern European kids, and then the other half were Native American reservation kids, and there are some like three or fourth cousins removed on my side of the family that I know still live on the reservation, but I never actually met them because the family lineage just kind of mm-hmm. died down like that. But I thought that was fascinating. Yeah. I like never actually asked her questions about the.
You better start asking before you'll think of them later. It'll be too late. But ask them while you can.
Yeah. What I was really struck by in the book was the humor in a lot of things, especially I think one of my personal favorite passages was, I believe it was you reminiscing about how blue-eyed kids can see. And mm-hmm. I thought that was very, very funny. Was humor like a part of this process as well? Or
humor is a part of my life.
Yeah.
I love to play with words and somebody will say something to me and I'll say something else back. You know, I know what they said, but my dad used to do that too. And so it was kind of a learned behavior, but I thought it was fun. So I just mm-hmm. carried it on. Yeah, I play with words a lot.
Oh, God, there's so much. I really love that passage. I think it's so funny. but one of the things I really wanted to talk about was in your biography, you also do a lot of work preserving and revitalizing the Ojibwe language. How does that work tie into this book? And I want you to kind of elaborate more on that.
I might have used a few Ojibwe words in there.
Yeah.
But it was mainly written in English. I have done work based on those stories that is all in Ojibwe, or it's bilingual and it's a series of cartoons that are found on the Fond du Lac Reservation language and culture website. They're out there as resources. And they're little cartoons. I'm going to bring those into the presentation I'll be doing later this month with the Minnesota Indian Education Conference.
Yep.
They invited me. They picked my book to put in the conference bag. So I thought I'll go down there and sign books and I'll tell them a little more about it. But a little more about it includes that I had already done other stories. There might be a story or two in my book that's also in the cartoons. Certainly will be reference to it. But they're just little, no more than 5-minute cartoons. And they're bilingual. There's a little book that goes along with them. People can read them either in English or in Ojibwe or both with mm-hmm. subtitles. So not sure I answered your question. I forgot to talk about that. I forgot what your question is.
I'm curious, how did you get into like this very laborious preserving the Ojibwe language? I'm kind of curious.
It's a struggle.
Yeah.
How did I get into it? My grandma. Of course. Everything leads back to grandma. She taught me words when I was just, you know, a little kid. I didn't really know what she was saying, but then I figured it out because she wouldn't say it in English.
Yeah.
And it's just real simple thing. Billy Sinin. Mm-hmm. And okay, Billy Sinin. And here she's setting the table, putting food on. Okay, I connect. That means come and eat.
Yeah.
So I learned by listening to her and watching what she was doing, and she just made it known what she meant. And I don't know, when I was in the city, big city, Detroit, Michigan, and I worked I was executive director of an Indian center. We had Indians from all over the country. It wasn't just Ojibwe, but they wanted to learn Ojibwe. We had a Navajo student coming to Ojibwe class.
Huh.
We had some Oneida students coming to Ojibwe class. Well, then we figured, well, they're across the border. Why don't we get a teacher from over there to come and teach them Oneida. And we have an Ojibwe instructor, you know, kind of built in. I mean, I couldn't do everything, but I could organize it. And if the instructor was absent, then I could step in. Mm-hmm. And it's more of a process of finding the resources to support it than to doing the actual work. Like, even after I stepped off the, I retired from being the Anishinaabe Mohn coordinator for Fond du Lac, mm-hmm. and I took a year to do some other things, including writing this book. And then I went back, and they, lo and behold, elected me to be the chair of the committee. Yes. I was going to go, and I just wanted to be, like, secretary or something. Minutes and all that kind of stuff, but they wanted me as chair. So I'm in my second term as chair, and I'm trying to get somebody groomed to step into that.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll happen, and maybe it won't happen in the near future. At some point it will happen. But I just keep pushing, and all the speakers I know, I try to sign them up to do presentations, or point them toward opportunities where they can present, because there's a lot of really good second language learners, and now they're teachers, and they just need to keep doing that, just keep recycling through and build it up. And that's what they're trying to do.
That is so beautifully said. Are you excited for the future of preserving the Ojibwe language and culture? Are you excited, like, looking forward in the near future to, like, newer generations?
I'm looking forward to people not losing momentum, which I've, from what I've seen since I've been back in Minnesota, it's been 10 years now. There's a lot of regional speakers, and they know each other, and they cooperate with each other, and they lift each other up. And that, to me, is a huge sign of hope. I love that. And I any of their presentations as I can. I had to miss two nights of our storytelling here that just took place last week because I had other meetings. And I thought, well, maybe I'll get out early enough to go. Well, I got out at 6:15 and it started at 6.
Yeah.
So to get from where I was over there, by the time I get there, it'd be almost over. So that kind of stuff is disappointing. But at least I know they went on with it, and they're doing it, and they're organizing it.
Oh, that's so cool. I want to kind of go back to the book a little bit, where you talk about walks with nature and grandma and all these other, definitely like the ties of her being in nature. Do you think that influenced you as a person quite a bit as well?
Oh, it definitely did. Yeah. If I hadn't had those walks out in nature and her encouragement to tell me about it and what I saw, I would not have the level of attention to detail that I have today. And it's not just out in the woods. It's everything around me.
Yeah.
It's just hypersensitive to any little detail.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes body language. I could look at people, and if they're saying one thing and doing another, I detect it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of know where most people are coming from when they're interacting with me.
Did you have a favorite story that your grandma told you, or one that you're like, this is one I want to be heard over and over and over again?
That was her story of Sugarbush.
Yep.
Her story of being born at Sugarbush. I never got tired of it, and neither did she.
Yeah.
And if she would not tell me, you know, for a while, she didn't mention, I'd say, Grandma, where were you born? Where exactly were you born? Or try to make her add that little turnabout's fair play, make her add a little more detail to what she's telling me. But she would tell the story, and she really liked it.
All right. My next, one of my last questions here, I think I have two more. What is your favorite memory of your grandma? If you had to pick a handful, I know it's very difficult for a personal question, but if you had one that's just like, this story or this memory really embodies who my grandma was as an individual, if you had to pick one.
Well, there was these quiet days we had when we did laundry. We did laundry outside the tubs. We had to haul the water and get it all ready and then hang it on the line. And that, you know, this is an all-day process. So while the laundry was drying, we didn't just sit there and wait. Mm-hmm. She was knitting a pot holder, and she had spare yarn and spare needles and waited for me to ask and say, come over here, I'm going to teach you how to do this. I said, Grandma, what are you doing? Oh, I'm making a pot holder. I said, oh, can I try? So she had a chair for me already. We always had the same chair as we sat on outside the door. So I went and sat by her, and she gave me the needles and showed me how to start. And here, do this and this, and showed me the stitch. And I did. And we sat there, and we were just talking. I was watching what I was doing, watching what she was doing. And she didn't say much. She just stopped. And we then she was done. So she finished hers, and I said, I think I'm done too. But I looked at mine, and it was about the size of a you know, those things you put under cups. What do you call those?
A coaster? You
set your coffee on. Coaster. Mine was only about the size of a coaster. Hers was the size of a regular pot holder. And I looked at it, and I looked at hers, and I said, oh, Grandma, I can't do it. It's miserable. I failed. I can't do it. And she picked it up, and she, here, let me see that. And she took it, and she turned it, and then she turned it sideways, looked at it. She said, oh, it's just right. Here, let me put a corner on it, and we're going to hang it on the wall side by side. Mm-hmm. I said, but yours is bigger. She said, that's okay. You just knit. You're a little tighter than I do, but this will work. So she never agreed with me that I was a failure. She looked at it and said, this is good. This will work. And so they hung there in our little kitchen, side by side, my little coaster next to her pot holder. But it had a little handle on it, just like hers. So, yeah, that is one of my favorite memories that really embodies who she was and how kind she was. She was just kind and such a teacher.
Oh, that's such a beautiful, note, a beautiful story. I really enjoyed listening to you recount that. And I think my final question is, based off of the story you just told me and any other facts that you would want people when they're reading the book to know about your grandmother or in Ojibwe culture in general?
Well, Grandma was really a smart woman. She was born in 1895, but during her young years and growing up years, Native people weren't really hired for anything. It didn't matter how smart they were. They could be laborers. They could be house cleaners, domestics. And I remember reading a letter to her that somebody wanted her to come and be their house cleaner because she had high recommendations from somebody else. And I thought, oh, my God, my grandma was so smart. She, I don't know if she took that job or not. She was a young lady when that letter came to her. But in her later life, she was the first woman on our reservation business committee. She is very smart. She worked at the organizing rights for Native people even before she got on that committee and long after she got off of it. She was a human rights activist. That's what I want people to know about her. She was a true matriarch. She looked after her family and she looked after the entire tribal nation.
That's
who my grandma was.
That's so sweet. I wish I could have met your grandma. I'm really grateful that you're able to. I'm very grateful that I'm able to meet your grandmother through you and through your book, Sugar Bush Babies. Thank you so much, Janice, for being with us today on KFAI 90.3 FM on Ride On Radio. It was such a pleasure having you on the air. And you're going to be at a conference this March 10th, right?
It's March 18th through 20th.
18th through 20th. All right.
Perfect. 18th through 20th. Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Well, thanks for jogging all my pleasant memories.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Programming is supported by Mutual Management Company. Mutual Management offers housing in Riverside Homes, a collection of vintage, low-density properties in the heart of the Riverside neighborhood. These homes feature unique layouts, strong connections to outdoor spaces, and the opportunity to build community within this vibrant area. Since 1980, Riverside Homes has helped preserve the character of this critical neighborhood. Learn more or explore available housing by contacting Mutual Management, MutualMGMTCompany.com, or by calling 612-333-9164. Make Riverside Homes your next home.
They say all good things must come to an end, but at Cafe I, we believe otherwise. The vehicle, once a source of countless memories and adventures, can continue to create positive change long after its last drive. By donating your car, truck, boat, or RV to Cafe I, you give it a new purpose and support the programming you love. To learn more about how you can extend the contribution of your vehicle's influence, call 855-277-2346 or visit kfai.careasy.org.
I'm Lady J, and did you know the first blues hit record was released by a woman? Join us on March 14th for more history from the ladies' side of the story as electronic, pop, Latin, rock, and jazz hosts inspire you with music and history starting at 6 a.m. on Saturday, March 14th. It's an event to raise some fun for KFAI pre-pledge drive. Join us Saturday, March 14th at 6 a.m. And that first blues hitmaker, that was Mamie Smith with the Crazy Blues in 1920.
This is Right On Radio, and today I am talking to Timothy Ott.
Oddie.
About Wild Rumpus Books. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Timothy Oddie. I'm a bookseller and writer, general book person around the Twin Cities, and one of the four co-owners of Wild Rumpus Books in the Linden Hills neighborhood of Minneapolis.
Awesome. Tell us a bit about your bookstore and what makes your bookstore unique.
Yeah, we like to think that we have one of the most unique bookstores in the Twin Cities. We are a children's specialty store, which means that most of the books that we stock are for readers ages 0 to 18, although we encourage grown-ups to read YA as well, and we do have a small selection of books for grown-ups. But I think the headline is that we have animals. We have a menagerie of animals. At the moment, we have two Manx cats, two chinchillas, a dove, a cockatiel, a crested gecko, and a fish tank in the bathroom. that I like to describe as being behind a magic mirror.
I did not see when I came to visit. I did not go to the bathroom, so I did not see the fish tank.
We always tell people, you got to go potty while you're in.
Yeah.
It's, you know, good practice for the kiddos, and there's surprises in there.
Someone was, I told someone that I was going to be interviewing you about Wild Rumpus Books, and they were like, oh, that's my favorite place when I was a child.
It's my favorite place as a grown-up,
yeah.
So I get it.
Yeah. Why focus on children's and young adult literature?
I think that is one of the biggest questions of my entire life. Children's books are, first of all, like how we read, but they are also in a lot of ways like how we come to understand the world. And for me, as someone that is, I like to think, you know, pretty engaged and culturally aware and has a lot of faith and hope in community. Like, if I want to carry that on into the future, one of the best ways to do that is to raise good readers now. So, you know, we feel really called to helping families, you know, meet very specific needs, whether that is like we just need a silly story time or like we're dealing with this, you know, intense or sad or scary thing that is happening either in our life or in our world. It is really important for us to meet the needs of families and those kids so that we can raise a generation that is hopefully better than ours. But also, like, kids' books are fun.
Yeah.
You know, like, I came up reading, like, you know, big epic fantasy, and I love a dragon in a mm-hmm. book. So, you know, sometimes that's all you need is just, like, a little escape to imaginative worlds that you get to ride a dragon or meet a unicorn or whatever in. Yeah, kids' books are fun and weird.
Yeah.
So...
What made you choose this career path? You said you're one of four co-owners mm-hmm. of yeah. the store of Wild Rumpus. Tell me more about that.
Well, for me personally, like I said, I'm also a writer. I make poems, and I will write a picture book just because I work so closely with them. There's a lot of overlap. So I've been a book person my entire life. I kind of... came to the book world that way. I was an English major, a theater major, and did a fellowship with the Loft Literary Center about a decade ago at this point. And really wonderful local author, Kaukalia Yang, was one of my mentors and asked kind of late in the fellowship, where do you want your writing to take you in 5 years? And I kind of froze up in the moment, and I was like, well, Kalia, I just want to read books and write books and talk about books. Like, where do I do that? How do I do that? Can I do that for a living? And that kind of set me on a path to working at a local publisher. I did a lot of literary criticism, that kind of thing. And in 2021, I got hired at Wild Rumpus to be a bookseller, and kind of immediately felt like, oh, this is the place that I was supposed to be the entire time. Mm-hmm. I get to be excited about the books I'm excited about and not kind of swayed by any, like, oh, this is the taste of our editor, our acquiring editor, and you have to kind of get on board with these books. I just get to be excited about yeah. books generally. And working with kids in particular is just fabulous. It's so, so fun. So when Colette Morgan, is one of the founding owners of the store, was talking about retiring, we started having conversations about what that meant for the future of the store. Mm-hmm. Again, because I felt like this is it. This is the first job I can imagine myself doing when I'm 60, and I don't want to lose that. So what's the best way for me to keep doing that? And when she said she was open to an offer from staff, we all kind of got together, the four of us, and we were like, we have to at least try. We will regret not trying mm-hmm. to buy this store. Mm-hmm. So it took a lot of work, a big lift, but we have, I think, the best team. And I'm so glad I get to do it with other people and not be the sole person responsible for everything. So that's the kind of short story of both me and our ownership team. Nice. We're excited about the future. It's been this is year 34 for the store. I was a kid when it when it was founded, and we get to imagine what it looks like to do this for another 34 years and hopefully more.
Yeah, amazing. Usually, when I usually ask why the Twin Cities, I'm usually asking, why open this bookstore in the Twin Cities? Mm-hmm. But for you, I guess it would be why the Twin Cities in terms of coming here for a literature-based job.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in St. Paul, so I didn't have to go very far. But that means that I have been a reader and a book person in the Twin Cities pretty much my entire life. And when we have authors visit the store from out of state, I'm always kind of doing a hard pitch for moving to the Twin Cities. Like, get out of New York, get out of LA. You don't need to be there. It's cheaper to live here, and we have a really incredible literary community. I genuinely think that the Twin Cities are the best place in the country to be a reader, especially a writer interested in books at all. At any point in the life of a book, you can plug in, whether that is at a bookstore or we have incredible libraries here. But there are publishers. There are distributors here. You can plug in, like, really on the back end, the infrastructure of making books. The Loft Literary Center, MFA programs, like, literally everything. And some of the best writers in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And I think a lot of other people would agree with that. I mean, we have people like Kate DiCamillo here. Like, come on, man. This is the best.
All right. How do you interact with the rest of the Twin Cities literary community that you just described?
Yeah, Wild Rumpus does a lot of author events, especially with local authors, things like book launches and story times. We have a local author section, so we stock a lot of authors, local authors on our shelves. When touring authors come through, one of the fun things that we get to do sometimes is put them in conversation with local writers and like make these connections. It's especially fun if you find out like, oh, these writers have known one another's work, but they've never met, and we got to facilitate that. That's a really, really fun experience. It's also really fun to, you know, have an author coming to town and think like, oh, there's this local author that I think would be really great in conversation. And neither of the authors know one another's work, and they leave and they're like, we got to stay in touch. Your book was incredible. I'm so glad that we got to do this.
Amazing.
So, you know, that's for us the really, really fun thing is like connecting authors, both locally, like with one another, but then with out of state authors as well. So that's kind of the main way that we interact with the local writing community and the local book community.
Okay. How do you choose which books to sell when space is at a premium? How do you curate your selection?
Yeah, we could have a whole hour-long conversation just about this. The kind of nuts and bolts are like working with reps from publishers. They send us markups to say, like, this is what this book is about. Here are some of the sales, like, keywords and that sort of thing. We see literally thousands of titles every year. So the more important part of that is, like, a curation policy, a philosophy. And for us, obviously, we're a children's specialty store. So children's books, YA books, middle grade books are mainly what we're looking for. And then within that, it's a matter of like, how do we want to best represent our community and make sure that as many possible stories are available? When a customer comes in with a very specific need or a very specific kind of cultural background, whether that is a family coming in and saying, you know, we're like mixed culture family, like I'm white and my husband is Indian, like what do you have books that kind of talk about these intersections of identity? Like, yeah, absolutely. Let's go find them. We've got them here already. Or I've got a kid that's obsessed with ants. How, are there books on ants? And like, yes, dozens. Let's go. So it's fun to find those books that we can bring in and have one copy of because we know someone at some point in the next year is going to come in and say, I have this very specific need. And we're going to be able to say, we have that exact book that you're looking for. It's been here waiting for you. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a broad strokes policy to, again, represent as many possible intersections of identity as we can and interests. I mean, kids are weird. They're into goofy, very specific. I mean, if you've talked to a kid.
I used to be preschool assistant teacher.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Very specific interests.
Very, very specific interests.
I had a dad come in recently with his kid, and he was like, they've been obsessed with this very specific advertisement on the back of buses that we see as we're commuting to and from preschool. Do you have books that have photographs of food in them? Photographs specifically. And yeah, absolutely. Like, we've got a section on food and cooking. Let's go take a look. Let's find something that's going to work for you.
It's really wonderful. So I used to work at a big box bookstore that shall not be named. And as someone who worked there, oftentimes, like, I could direct you towards something that was kind of like what you might be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could be like, look it up in the database and say, hey, this location might have this book.
Right.
But I always wanted to be able to say, hey, we've got a bunch of local bookstores that might fit what you're looking for better and might be able to help you more.
Yeah.
Because you have the ability to not just stock, like, the newest thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to your point about, like, the local bookstores, we our bookstore community is so vibrant that like we get to do that sometimes. Like when people come looking for, you know, say a very specific kind of romance trope, we get to say, well, you know, we've got some YA romance, but I think what you're actually looking for, you'll find at Tropes and Trifles. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, more like niche sci-fi and fantasy. Like we've got The Uncles, we've got Dreamhaven. Mm-hmm. Like we've got these stores that can really specifically cater to all types of tastes. So it's really fun to be able to say, like, I don't necessarily have exactly what you're looking for, but I know exactly where to send you to find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you stay relevant with box stores, online retailers, and ebooks?
Yeah. I mean, I think things like our animals are a really unique space. We have a little purple door inside of our adult door.
I've had multiple people that I've mentioned this interview to talk to me about the little kid door.
Yeah.
The door for kids.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, I mean, I encourage everyone to use it. If you're able to, even as a grown up, you're welcome to use that door. I think of that door kind of as a metaphor for what we're doing, which is that it is a portal into all of these worlds that we get to imagine together. Mm-hmm. And that portal works both ways. And our hope is that kids kind of come in, they find something in a book that inspires them to do something out in the real world, and they take whatever that is back out that little door, and we get to make the best of those imaginative worlds a reality here on Earth in our community.
Yeah.
So, you know, things like that, like, do keep us relevant in that way. We've had multiple people over the years, like, I mean, the number of people every week that say, I came here as a kid and now I'm bringing my kids, or like, I brought my kids and now I'm bringing their kids is really, really cool. So I think just like that kind of thing, those kind of core memories that we get to be a part of are one of the things that keep us relevant. Yeah. That very specific knowledge of the books that we have keeps us relevant. That's not something that an algorithm is going to give to you.
Yeah.
You have to go to someone that really understands the world of children's books to get the best and weirdest of those recommendations. I mean, not even just children's books, but again, talking about the vibrant bookstore community, like all of the booksellers at those stores are category experts in whatever kind of curation philosophy that store has. The booksellers there understand what they're doing on a very deep fundamental level. Mm-hmm. And can give you a really good recommendation, especially if you're savvy enough to be like, okay, well, what's the book that you wish you could read again for the first time? Or what's a book that not enough people are picking up right now that you're so excited about? Like, asking questions like that can really get you to some great, great recommendations.
Oh, yeah.
I should also say, I mean, you know, we're online too. We have a website. You can order books on our website. We ship all over the country. We do ebooks through bookshop.org. We do audiobooks through libro.fm. Mm-hmm. And these are not just Wild Rumpus things. Like most indie bookstores have some sort of partnership that can get you things like ebooks and audiobooks. So we can kind of do everything that those big online retailers can do. And we have more expertise. Mm-hmm. We can do it better.
Going off of that, how do you feel about Indie Bookstore Day?
Oh, Indie Bookstore Day is a lot of fun. It could be chaotic for sure. Mm-hmm. Last year we had almost 40 bookstores participating in the Twin Cities Passport. I think we might be able to top that this year, which is just incredible. So, yeah, I mean, it's a fun day. It's a big celebration. It feels like a big party that's taking place kind of across the entire region.
It really does.
So, you know, I love it. I mean, we get to the end of that day exhausted, but it feels like, oh, yeah, no. We got to meet every single one of our people. Like, yeah. Everyone that walked through is a new friend.
Amazing.
Or potentially, right? Like, it's really, really fun.
Nice. What do you wish you knew when you started?
Oh, boy. So much. I feel really lucky that I did a liberal arts education, and I had a lot of people in my life say the more skills that you can get, the better off you're going to be later. Mm-hmm. And I have found that extremely true, especially as a a relatively new small business owner. I mean, I've worked at small businesses pretty much my entire working life. Mm-hmm. And even just knowing how to plunge a toilet, things like that come up more often than you'd expect.
As someone who, again, used to work at a preschool, I fully understand.
It happens. It happens. So, every skill, I think, is relevant when you work at a small business, and especially at a bookstore. Every niche area of interest that you have can and will come up when you're talking with customers. I mean, again, talking about the very specific interests and desires of kids, man, when they hit, when you're like, oh, actually, I know this deeply. Mm-hmm. Like, if you can rap about Pokemon with a 7-year-old, you're golden. I wish I knew more of that kind of stuff when I started. But also, when I was first kind of getting into the book world, I think I had the sense that the two jobs were writer and editor. Mm. And then, secondarily to that was bookseller and librarian. And all of those roles are important. There are so many other things that you can do with books, getting into production editing, how do you make a book? Mm-hmm. How do you go from this manuscript in a Word doc to a thing that is bound in a spine and lives on a bookshelf at a bookstore or a library? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of steps that are involved in getting there. And I wish I had a better sense of how to do that when I first started. Mm-hmm. I think my career could have looked a lot different had I known. So I always encourage young people, anyone that's interested in getting into books, to really think about what are the skills that you have? What are the things that make you excited about making books? And find something that is not just I have good taste and I can pick the good books or write the good books. You can. And do you have good taste when it comes to cover design? Can you typeset? Mm-hmm. There are so many other things that are great. Can you talk about books really well? You can be a publicist. Mm-hmm. There are so many jobs that are involved in getting a book from that first seed of an idea to the final product that you find out in the world, and lots of different ways that you can plug in. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to learn, actually, the thing that I really want to do is over there, and I hadn't thought about it yet.
Going off of that, what is your favorite part of being a bookseller?
Oh, just being a dork. I get to be a dork about books with kids. Truly nothing will beat the high of having a young customer come back and say, that book that you recommended was really good. Do you have something else? Nothing in my life will top that. So if I can just live in moments like that forever, I'll be golden.
Going towards the opposite direction, what is one question you wish you never had to hear again?
I have a very specific one for our bookstore, which is, what happened to your chicken?
Oh, no.
Our chicken is fine. She just was not interested in being a bookstore chicken any longer. Mm. She moved to a small hobby farm in 2021. It has been 5 years since that chicken left our store, and not a day has gone by that someone hasn't asked about Neil. So we love her. We miss her very dearly. And I surely, going on the radio, will get to that last person who somehow is missed that we don't have a chicken any longer. But I don't know. Beyond that, things like, if I never have to answer another question about, the big online river that everyone buys from, that'd be fine. Yeah. I mean, I get it. I understand.
Yeah.
They're the big elephant in the room.
Yeah.
But there's so many good books that we could talk about instead.
Yeah. As a bookseller, do you find time to read books? And what is on your book? What is on your nightstand?
Yes, we are professionally obligated to read. There's a lot of reading that goes on. How do I even approach this question? I'm a the kind of person that's always reading a lot all at once. I'm listening to audiobooks. I usually have a collection of poetry that I'm, you know, slowly dipping into, and, you know, middle grade YA, books for grown-ups, a little of all of it. So in terms of, like, picture books in particular, obviously I can sit down and read a dozen picture books in a day.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah.
Love to do it. Some of my favorite recent, like, new-ish creators, and forgive me if I mispronounce some of these names. I only ever see them written on book covers. But Natalia Shalashovili, she's got a great book called Miss Leoparda that came out a couple of years ago. Her new one is called Sasha Feels Shy. Really great illustrations. I really, really love her work. X Fang, who has a new book called Broken. Excellent, excellent picture book creator, great illustrator. Linda Liu has written some really, really fun picture books. Her illustration style reminds me a little bit of John Klassen, who is kind of a modern classic illustrator.
He's the one who's...
We Found a Hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
The trilogy.
The trilogy. The most perfect trilogy. I'm very sorry to Tolkien, but...
Yeah.
You know, the Hat trilogy...
It's perfect.
So, yeah, I mean, picture book illustrators like them. I have been recently, like, going back to kind of the early days of picture books, reading a lot of Wanda Gogg, who did Millions of Cats and is a Minnesotan. Fun fact. Yeah, I could talk about picture books all day. Some other like YA and middle grade books. I'm reading Estela Undrowning by Renee Peña Gouveia. That book comes out in March. Really reminds me of like The Poet X by Elizabeth Acevedo. If you're interested in like a coming of age story that involves a lot of poetry but isn't a novel in verse, Estela Undrowning is for you. The Moon Without Stars by Chanel Miller just came out. She was a Newbery Honor for her first book, Magnolia Woo Unfolds It All, which is also excellent. I think one of my favorite books from this past fall by Victoria Zeller called One of the Boys. I love a book that takes trans identity and football seriously. Like both of those themes very, very seriously. You know, there's all sorts of conversations about trans kids in sport, and this book is such a good depiction of a trans girl playing football. I loved it so much. And for grown-ups, one of the ones that I'm really, really excited about coming out in April is called The Neverending Book. It's by Naoki Matayoshi and Shinsuke Yoshinitake, who is a very weird, like, illustrator, like, has these very oddball, very funny picture books. These two teamed up to make this book that feels like a mix of, like, 1001 Nights meets Italo Calvino. It's about these this king who loves books, but he's going blind. So he asks these two people to go out into the kingdom and find all of the most unusual books and come back and tell him about them. So they do. And I thought it was going to be sort of a silly, like, fun book about books, and it is a deeply profound meditation on the ways that books shape us as people. There's a really wonderful twist to it as well that I won't spoil, but I was fully weeping reading that one on a random Sunday night, feeling like, oh, I'll just dip into this fun little illustrated novel. And was suddenly texting all of my friends, like, you need to pre-order this book. I think it's going to be my favorite of 2026.
Do you have anything coming up that you want people to know about?
I mean, always. We do story times every Tuesday morning. Those are open to all ages. They're so fun. Have you been?
I have not, but I had someone earlier today ask me if you still do story times.
Yes. Every Tuesday, we do story times. Our story time leaders are so, so good at it, to the point that our staff holiday party every year we have a story time that they lead as part of it. We read some holiday books together. They do all the voices. They sing songs. Kids get to stand up and stamp their sillies out a little bit. So, yeah, that's every Tuesday. It is the most fun that we have. And then we do, like I said earlier, author events pretty regularly. We have a newsletter, and that's kind of the best way to plug in on that kind of thing. And then coming up this summer, every summer we do a Waldo, a Find Waldo throughout the Linden Hills neighborhood with as many local businesses as we can. You get to wander through those businesses and look for Waldo and get your passport stamped when you find him.
Amazing.
So that's always a ton of fun. We have a lot of summer reading programs, so there's often something going on that is worth plugging into.
This has been Timothy Oddie of Wild Rumpus Books. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. This is a delight.
And now, this.